Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, all my people. Welcome to the show on this fine Martin Luther King Jr. Day. This is Splash, and my pond is open. What a great long weekend that went by way too fast. We've got a great show for you tonight. Lots to cover, lots to sink our teeth into. The number to call, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. And I encourage you to jump right in, wade carefully if you must. But remember, in my pond, everyone swims at their own risk. We'll be here for the next hour doing the thing I love to do most, talking smack about politics. We now have a blog, so all our shows are posted there, past, present, and future. Go to 1111broadcasting.com. That's the numerals, 1111broadcasting.com. And you can listen to a show, make comments and suggestions, or just say hi. You can also follow me on Facebook at 1111broadcasting. The Facebook page is new, so, you know, I'm not well-versed in the world of social media. I'm learning as I go. So every time someone friends me, I learn something new and different. If you miss a show, don't sweat it. The show links are listed on the blog. So just go to 1111broadcasting.com. You can catch up if you like. You can jump right into our show chat room tonight. You'll just need a free login from Blog Talk Radio. It takes less than a minute. Put in your email address, pick a screen name and password, and voila, you can jump right into the chat room, pick on people, or pick on me, if you like. I try and keep up with what's going on in there, if anybody is actually in there. And, of course, you don't need to create an account to call. Just dial the number right there at the top of the show page, 215-383-5730, and I would love to talk to you. You can put me to the test. It'll be your time to shine. Anyway, lots happening all over the place this weekend. There's no way I'm going to be able to touch on it all, but I have picked out a few topics tonight. And we're going to have fun with that. If you have any news items or anything that happened that you'd like to talk about, certainly give us a call. Jump right into the show. The number is 215-383-5730, 215-383-5730. Before we get into the show, let me tell you about Choice Mattress and Furniture. When it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and his staff at Choice Mattress and Furniture know their stuff. I took my family to Choice Mattress and everything was considered, from our weight to our age to even the way each of us sleeps. The right mattress was personally selected for each of us. Now my whole family sleeps in great comfort all night long on beds from Choice Mattress, and yours can too. Every mattress carried by Choice Mattress comes with a 5, 10, or even 15-year 100% full replacement warranty, not a prorated limited warranty like other stores. Chances are, if you bought a bed in Daytona Beach area in the last 20 years, then you bought it from David. With over 20 years of experience, David knows beds. And you should see all the other fine lines of furniture Choice Mattress has for every room in your house. Go see David and the fine folks at Choice Mattress and Furniture, located on the corner of LPGA and North Nova Road, 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill, or give them a call, 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice that you can make in your sleep. Some interesting conflicting information this week. Of course, we read lots of stories in all the media, how excited they are that Barack Obama's job approval rating is up. In December, the 27th through 29th, it was at 48%, and even after his missing in action in Paris, he was at 46%, according to Gallup. This, of course, marks the first time Obama's approval-disapproval gap has not been negative since September of 2003. Obama's job approval rating has been trending upward in general in recent weeks, of course, since the midterm elections. Real easy to do for a president when they're starting to lack relevance and they lost both chambers of the Congress. These are his overall average for 2014 so far was 42%, so not a whole lot to brag about. This is a three-day running total or running poll that the Gallup does. And they've been doing it on presidents for years. So some of this uptick, of course, is due to higher ratings amongst Hispanics who reacted favorably to Obama's action on immigration. Makes perfect sense that he announced in November. Some of it may reflect his recent announcements concerning the restoration of relations with Cuba. Hard to say that that had a whole big impact on anywhere other than Southern Florida, and there were mixed reviews down there. Some may reflect America's increasing positive views of the economy and jobs picture, and that, I think, would probably be the bigger impact, if anything, on any kind of leap in Obama's numbers. Some may be the Christmas bump, reflecting Americans' more charitable attitudes in and around the Christmas season. Okay. The three-day job approval averages are, of course, quite fluid. The president's ratings may tick down in the days ahead. Still hitting that 48% is a pretty big deal for Obama. So Obama's approval ratings are up, or are they? Reuters reported a dive in the president's approval rating. Just 37% approve of Obama in the weeks that he missed the march in Paris, the March of Solidarity. President Obama's public approval ratings for Reuters has dropped to 37%, 55% disapproving of his job performance, according to their poll, tracking poll for the year. The poll clashes, of course, with Gallup, which last had Obama at 46%. That's right after the Charlie Hebdo attacks and subsequent misstep by the Obama administration. During this period, the president was hit for not sending an important member of his team to protest in Paris over the reaction of al-Qaeda terror killings. Worse, with the GOP in charge of Congress, more say that Republicans have better plans on the economy, taxes, and foreign policy than do the Democrats. That's according to the Reuters poll. Democrats, however, continue to hold the edge on the environment and welfare. The poll was conducted January 10th through 14th and included a nice mix, 634 Democrats, 646 Republicans, and 230 independents. Overall, 56% said that the nation is on the wrong track, while 26% said the nation is on the right track. The national poll was released along with one that looks at how blacks and Hispanics and whites view the police. The bottom line, 70% of blacks and 52% of Hispanics Hispanic Americans agree that police officers tend to unfairly target minorities. Not a big surprise compared to 29% of whites who agree with that statement. So anyway, the primary disagreement between the approval ratings for President Obama, not exactly in tune with one another there. Hard to actually keep track of that. The what do you think about these contradicting polls? You can give us a call. Let's talk about it. Come swim into my pond. The number to call, 215-383-5730, 215-383-5730. Something else that caught my attention, probably everybody else's attention as well, was Barack Obama taking what he would consider a lead step. I don't know how lead step this is. Considering tax reform has been being bantied about now for the last couple of years. President Obama would basically take from the rich and give to everyone else as part of a sweeping tax plan he intends to push Tuesday night in his State of Union address. This is this really gets to me because they're comparing Obama to Robin Hood, of course. So let's call him Obama Hood. It's just too much. You know what else is too much? This tax plan. Not because I disagree with any of it, because I don't. I'm all for tax cuts, always have been. I think the less money we give to our government, the less money they have of ours to waste. But because I disagree with this plan, because it is classical liberal regressive class warfare at its finest. First of all, Obamahood has been in office for 6 years. Where was his offers to rob the rich and feed the poor then? I mean, he did agree to raise the taxes on the rich. At first, he didn't. Remember, the whole first discussion when Obama's first Congress was in was, do we let the Bush tax cuts sunset for the wealthiest 1% or the wealthiest 2%, or do we not? And Obama's decision, and actually what he pushed for, was not to, because he knew that it would hurt whatever chance at recovery he had early on. Little did he know he would hurt a lot of that all on his own. But his first 6 years, he didn't do much of robbing the rich to feed the poor, not to the magnitude that this plan is being touted. Where was this proposal then? Where was this proposal when he had at least some of the power to enact it in the last 4 years? And especially, where was he when he had all the power that he needed to do it? He was nowhere to be found. I guess he was probably lost somewhere in Sherwood Forest, a golf course. And here's another reason I know that this is simple class warfare. Obamahood himself supports lowering the corporate tax rate. It is one of the few tax issues on which he and Elmos agree. And they should. I mean, of course, Obama has been holding this issue hostage. Even though the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rate in the world, he's been holding it hostage so he can get some other goodies, tax goodies that he would like, or even spending priorities that he would like. Well, here he's asking for all the goodies with absolutely no mention of a corporate tax rate cut. So this is pure, classical, dyed-in-the-wool, liberal, regressive class warfare. This Robin Hood-style proposal would raise taxes on capital gains and close various breaks for the wealthy in order to finance more generous education, family, and retirement benefits for those further down the income ladder. None of this do I disagree with. But by ensuring that those at the top pay their fair share, the president's responsibly pays for the investment we need to help the middle-class families. This was an administration summary. Of course, it faces long odds in a Republican-controlled Congress, where lawmakers have bitterly complained about a string of recent tax increases on the wealthy. That's not why they disagree with this. They disagree with it because the tax increases are bad for the economy. That's why the Elmos disagree with that particular portion of the plan. They're not even really that much in disagreement with the various tax cuts for the middle class. It's the other parts of it that they take great issue with. In other words, they negotiated a tax increase on the wealthy back in 2011. Now, by the way, when they negotiated that tax increase, Obama was the one that chose to go for the increase in the tax rate on the upper half of percent. He was offered by John Boehner. He was offered by John Boehner to eliminate loopholes instead that block, that keep it so that the rich end up not having to pay the taxes. Obama opted out of that. Obamahood opted out of that possibility and chose the higher tax rate, primarily because it looks better on him to raise the tax rate on the wealthy rather than close loopholes nobody even knows about. In other words, they negotiated a tax increase on the wealthy back in 2011, and now Obama wants more. Why? Because he wants to remain relevant with the masses. That's why. And how does a populist do that? By showering the masses with gimmies, freebies, and goodies. We just talked about Obamahood's polling numbers being in the tank. So what does he want to do? He wants to buy your love again with another round of goodies. First, let me say this. I love goodies. I would love to have my child tax credit tripled. I pay taxes. That would be a great benefit to me. I'll take it. Give it here. I would love another $500 tax credit because both adults in our household work. I would love it if the earned income tax credit was expanded to include me. Of course, I don't like illegal aliens getting any of their hands on these things that are intended for U.S. citizens or those people that came here legally. But I do definitely believe in all of these things. Keep that money in our pockets. We know how to better spend it. Unlike Bill Clinton said, we know how to spend our money better for us than the government certainly does. So now, should we raise the capital gains tax? Well, let's ask that another way. Should we cut the amount of capital that investors are willing to sink into this economy, thereby helping its recovery? Because that's what could happen. In order to have capital gains to tax, one first has to invest capital. That's the requirement. Now, there are some out there that would say these people are going to invest no matter what, and that may be true. But they have no way to know that for certain. And secondly, there are companies out there that invest in risky startup businesses that end up growing and creating jobs, and all of that counts as capital gains. That's what they make their money on. So if you raise that, you're going to have two problems. Number one, they may not invest as much. But number two, once they do invest that money and they get their returns, any higher capital gains tax that you take out of that, they usually roll that money into new ventures. So it leaves less money to roll into new ventures. So these are things that we need to consider. But here's the problem. The masses don't know that much, if anything at all, about capital gains, except that it's taxed at a lower rate, and that it's taxed at a lower rate than the regular rate on income. And that says a lot, and that a lot of rich people have them. So those are the two things they know about capital gains. Number one, it's taxed at a lower rate than regular income. And number two, that lots of rich people have capital gains. And in their effort to stoke the fires of class warfare, the Smurfs, and especially Obamahood, are taking full advantage of this lack of knowledge by the average person. So let's talk about capital gains, and especially the tax our government places on it, because this is something that I think we all should understand. We should understand, and it's not something that's really difficult to understand. It's not. You'll see in a moment, but this was from an article from investors.com back in 2012 when Obama was pushing to raise the capital gains tax. The top federal tax rate on capital gains was set to increase from 15% to 23.8%. That was an expiration of the Bush tax cuts that was about to take place. That would push the rate up 5%. And then Obamacare and the Obamacare investment tax would add an additional 3.8%. So it was going to go up a whole 8.8%. Now, some policymakers view low capital gains taxes as an unfair loophole. But capital gains are unique. The low rate on gains boosts entrepreneurship, investment, and growth. And that's the whole reason that they were taxed, that the tax was lowered in the first place. But here's something to know. Because we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world, the average tax rate on capital gains among the 34 nations of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that's the OECD, is just 16.4%. So we were right in that mix. But by contrast, the U.S. rate, including the federal and state taxes, will jump to over 27.9% next year. That was back in 2012, should all this come into play. In other words, the Bush 5% was allowed to sunset, and the 3.8% from Obamacare, and then state taxes as well, 27.9%. It's ridiculously high compared to the other industrialized nations. The U.S. policymakers need a refresher course, actually, on why capital gains tax rates should be kept low. And they have an obligation to share with the public why it's lower, rather than using it as a bully pulpit for class warfare and to ignite the passions of those people whose votes that they would purchase. But there are several reasons why capital gains are taxed at a lower rate and should be taxed at a lower rate. Number one is inflation. You buy a stock for $10 today and you sell it later for $12, much of that $2 in capital gains may be inflation, not just real return. You sell it 10 years from now and you're going to end up paying a much higher tax rate on, because you're paying it on capital gains where the dollar has been inflated, and you should, and that's expected. and it reduces the real returns in increased uncertainty, which suppresses investment, particularly in growth companies. One solution is to index capital gains for inflation. So in other words, if I buy something today for $100,000, and let's say we shot to double-digit inflation from the Jimmy Carter days, and that it's worth $900,000 today, 10 years from then, well, all of a sudden, the real value compared to when I purchased it is really only about $500,000. And so you index it to inflation, so I would end up paying the tax only on the inflation-adjusted value. That's one way to do it, of course. But instead, they did the lock-in. Capital gains are taxed on a realization basis, which creates a lock-in. Taxpayers delayed selling investments that have a large unrealized gains to avoid the tax hit. As a result, people hold on to assets too long and forego beneficial diversification opportunities for the overall income. Lock-in reduces growth rate because it blocks the beneficial shifting of resources from lower to higher valued assets. But instead, what we did was tax the capital gains at a lower rate, knowing that depending on how long or short term a tax rate is, I mean a sale of those or the capital gains are realized, the more impact inflation has on those capital gains. So they are taxed lower. There's a double taxation on capital gains. Corporations' corporate share values generally equal the present value expected for future earnings. Now, if expected earnings rise, shares will increase in value, creating a capital gain to the individual. But those future earnings will be taxed at the corporate level when they occur, thus hitting individuals now with a capital gains tax that is double taxation. So dividends are also double taxed, with the result that the U.S. tax system is biased against corporate equity and in favor of debt. This destabilizes companies and the overall economy. Ernst & Young calculates that the current U.S. combined corporate and individual rate on capital gains at about 50.8%, which again is why they are taxed at a lower rate, because if you tax them at the same rate, that 50.8% would be somewhere in the vicinity of about 65 to 70%. Compared to the average, by the way, that 50.8% compares to the average OECD country rate overall of 42%. So again, we're way out of whack. Now, our tax burden on dividends is equally out of line. The U.S. disadvantage will get much worse next year when they were talking about 2013, when the scheduled tax hikes on capital gains would come into play. Of course, they didn't all come into play. Only part of them did. Here's another reason why we should keep capital gains lower, capital gains taxes lower. And that's got to do with competitiveness. Capital has become highly mobile across borders, prompting nearly every country in recent decades to cut tax rates on corporations, wealthy estates, dividends, and capital gains. U.S. politicians get on a high horse and denounce individuals and firms that shift investment abroad. But the mobility of capital is a permanent reality. It just cannot be denied. The world has gone global. The higher the tax rate on capital, the more job-creating investments are scared away. When Canada cut its federal capital gains tax rate to 14.5%, a parliamentary report proposed that international competitiveness be the criterion guiding the choice of a capital gains tax regime. Another reason to keep capital gains low is the growth of companies. Reducing capital gains taxes encourages entrepreneurship because capital gains payoff from a successful startup is improved relative to a wage job. Low taxes also boost outside investment from angels and venture capitalists. There's two different categories. They're both basically venture capitalists because their reward for taking risk on unproven young companies is a possible gain years down the road. The higher the tax rate on gains, the fewer projects potential projects that will get the green light. Angel investors are usually high earners who could alternatively invest in safer assets such as tax-free municipal bonds. The capital gains tax rate directly affects their willingness to fund startups and growth companies. Furthermore, when angels exit their investment, and I was talking about this earlier, they often use their after-tax returns to fund more young companies in the ongoing virtuous cycle. Higher capital gains taxes would drain cash out of the reinvestment cycle, which has been at the core, for example, of Silicon Valley's success since capital gains taxes were slashed in the late 70s. You know, that is the core. Most of what happens in Silicon Valley relies, all the new startups and everything rely on venture capital money to get them going and get them started. And it's just like any other tax or anything else. When you extract money from a business or industry, you extract opportunity. That's why taxes in general should be kept low, not just the capital gains tax. Of course, the government revenue. A recent Congressional Budget Office study, the CBO, found that longer-term responsiveness of capital gains realizations to the tax rate is quite large. It found a persistent elasticity of, and the number doesn't matter, negative 0.79, which means that a 10% cut in the tax rate would increase ongoing realization by 7.9%. So this indicates that the government's revenue loss from a capital gains tax cut would be a fraction of what a static score would show, and its gain from a tax hike would also, inversely, be very small. Aside from increasing realizations, capital gains tax cuts also boost share prices, increase investment in growth companies, and spur greater entrepreneurship. The economy would enjoy more innovation and higher productivity, which would translate into higher incomes for all workers over time. As the economy expands, the government would also win as tax revenues from all sources would increase because of it. These advantages of low capital gains taxes have led many economists over the decades, from Irving Fisher to Alan Greenspan, to call for ending these taxes altogether. 11 of the OECD countries today don't tax long-term capital gains at all. So on the heels of this, let's go back to Obamahood's class warfare to buy the people's love and his tax plan. Well, so we'll go on back to that. But before we do, let me remind you when it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and his staff at Choice Mattress and Furniture know their stuff. My whole family is now sleeping in beds from Choice Mattress, and you cannot say enough about the benefits of a great night's sleep on the right mattress chosen just for you. Every mattress carried at Choice Mattress comes with a 5, 10, or even 15-year, 100% full replacement warranty, not a prorated limited warranty like other stores. And check out all the other fine lines of furniture Choice Mattress has for every room in your home. Go see David and the fine folks at Choice Mattress and Furniture, located at 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill. That's on the corner of LPGA and Nova Road, right in the Winn-Dixie parking lot, one of the outbuildings there. Or give David a call, 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice you can make in your sleep. So now we're getting back to Obama and his plan to buy the love of the people. And here's five things that we're going to talk about on his plan, five things you need to know. This is from a Politico article. The administration wants to increase the top capital gains tax rate, of course, to 28% from the current rate of 25% with various surcharges. Now, the 25% is because of the Obama tax and the sunset of the Bush tax, and there was a little bit of an adjustment there, but they want to increase it to 28% with various surcharges on top of that, while expanding the number of things that would be subject to it. So in other words, not just on those things that are subject to the capital gains tax now, but actually expanding the number of things that could be subject to the capital gains tax. So here's how it works. If you sell a stock for $1 million that you bought for $100,000, you would pay capital gains on the $900,000 profit. But if you die and your kids get the stock, he or she is excused from paying taxes on those $900,000. Now, this is just a simple inheritance thing. It's always been thus. Now, for your child, the new starting point in calculating capital gains tax is on the $1 million. Why? Because they invested they inherited $1 million in value, not $100,000 in value. So the $900,000 escapes taxation. That's true. That's true of any capital gains that you pass to anybody. It doesn't have to be $1 million. The reason they give you an example of $1 million is because they want it to sound rich, like it only applies to the rich, and it doesn't. It's a tax break that mostly, though not exclusively, benefits the wealthy, and it doesn't even mostly benefit the wealthy. About 21% of the tax benefit goes to the top 1%. So it doesn't mostly benefit them, but it does benefit them in a more extreme way because they have more wealth. It just makes perfect sense that it works that way. It's a tax break that goes mostly to the wealthy, according to the article. According to the Congressional Budget Office, it cost the Treasury about $50 billion in 2013, which means if 21% of that went to the wealthy, that would be $10 billion. So a good 79% of this went to the rest of the earners in the country. The administration's plan would end the step-up basis loophole, that's what they call it, though it would add, according to Obama, various provisions aimed at shielding the non-wealthy and small businesses from having to pay that tax. Now remember, Obama defines non-wealthy as under $200,000 a year. So if you make $200,000 a year, he's probably not thinking about shielding you from this aspect. So just bear that in mind. It really all depends on what the definition of wealthy and non-wealthy turns out to be. But it would be the latest in a string of increases in capital gains taxes under Obamahood. Lawmakers agree to raise the top tax rate to 20% for the wealthy taxpayers from 15%. That was part of the 2013 fiscal cliff agreement, remember, where they allowed that Bush tax cut to expire. And they also imposed a surtax on itemized deductions, the so-called PEAS provision. That can add another percentage point in taxes. The Affordable Care Act, meanwhile, was financed in part by the new 3.8% investment tax. Together, these provisions raise everything up to 25%, and there's still surcharges on top of that. The administration notes that 28% rate would match the levy under President Ronald Reagan. Yay, they invoked Ronald Reagan's name again. This is what these guys always do. Ronald Reagan lowered all these taxes from massive percentages, and then they brag when they want to increase them because that was what Ronald Reagan lowered them to. The top income tax back then was 28%, while income tax is currently topped out at 39.6% right now, not including various surcharges. So under Obama's plan, capital gains taxes would almost double. What almost have doubled from 2012. Doubled, folks. Did I say doubled? Because what I meant to say was doubled. That's really something. And he wants to expand the middle and low-income family tax credits. I have no problem with this. Anytime you give a tax credit or tax cuts to anyone, I think it's a good thing. The administration's plan would extend expiring parts of the child tax credit, the earned income tax credit for lower income workers, and create a new $500 second earner credit. The new provision is aimed at married couples, particularly those with young children, who may feel that it doesn't make economic sense for both of them to work. Okay, now, when both spouses work, The family incurs additional costs in the form of commuting costs, professional expenses, child care, increasing elder care. This is the administration statement, and all true. When layered on top of other costs, including federal and state taxes, these work-related costs can contribute to the sense that it isn't really worth it. The credit would phase out with income, though couples earning up to $210,000 could claim at least a portion of the break. The other provisions would boost the maximum child care tax credit to $3,000. I was talking about this earlier. I would love to have that. You know, that would be awesome. I would do a lot more with that money, including spend it and right back into the economy than the government could ever do with that. And, of course, they want to expand the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, for childless workers. Okay. I would still go along with that. Of course, the Elmos have a love-hate relationship with the Earned Income Tax Credit, particularly since it became politically toxic when Obama Hood's executive order on immigration. That's because the illegal immigrants can currently claim a separate child tax credit, while under Obama's immigration initiative, they may be able to claim the Earned Income Tax Credit as well. Both are refundable, which means that the tax credits exceed a taxpayer's bill, of course, they get the money back. And, of course, the Elmos are balking at the $400 billion tax deal. In part, they balked it in November, in part because the administration demanded expanding both credits. The Republicans don't want to look like they're giving tax credits to illegal immigrants, and that's why they wouldn't go along with that, and I can certainly understand that. That's kind of important. It's important to a lot of people that illegals don't get the tax breaks. Education breaks. The administration wants to extend the American Opportunity Tax Credit, the administration's signature higher education tax benefit that is scheduled to expire in 2017. He wants to make it more valuable to low-income students as well. If you don't know, this tax credit was part of Obama's Spendulous plan, giving a $4,000 tax credit in exchange for 100 hours of community service. Now he's talking about giving free 2 years of community college to everyone. Now they don't have to give community service in exchange. The act was specifically aimed at the years 2009 and 2010, but has since been expanded through 2017, and focuses on the first 4 years of post-secondary education. It also increased the HOPE scholarship credit to 100% qualified tuitions, fees, and course materials paid by the taxpayer during the taxable year, not to exceed $2,000 a year, plus 25% of the next $2,000 for another $500 in qualified tuition fees and course materials. The total credit not to exceed $2,500. 40% of that credit is refundable, and the tax credit is subject to a phase out for taxpayers with adjusted gross incomes in excess of $80,000, $160,000 for married couples filing jointly. Obama also wants to fix an issue for which those who join a government program that forgives student loan debts after borrowers make payments for 20 years can be socked with unexpected and big tax bills. Wants to fix that. That's because the IRS considers forgiven debt to be equivalent to income and taxes it. Under the administration's plan, that would stop. I don't have any problem with that either, because it, again, gives less taxes to the government for them to waste. Other parts of the administration's plan would exempt Pell Grants, which go to students from low-income families, from taxation. I got to tell you, I was a low-income student. I had Pell Grants, and they never taxed my Pell Grants. I don't know what you're talking about there. Maybe that's changed between when I was in college and now. The administration proposes to finance the breaks, at least in part, by taking away education breaks for the well-off. Because remember, folks, if you're rich, you really aren't an American anyway. Details are thin, or even well-off, for that matter. Details are thin, but the administration says it would limit upside-down education savings incentives by rolling back Section 529, blah, 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 from the George Bush, and it's everything's his fault. Okay, moving on, the Mitt Romney loophole. I love this. The administration plan would target those who accumulate giant balances in tax-preferred retirement accounts, an issue that became the spotlight in 2012. I've got to tell you, I don't remember this. After reports that then-Republican presidential candidate Mitt Romney had at least $21 million in an IRA while he was working for Bain Capital. Tax-preferred retirement plans are intended to help working families save for retirement, the administration said. Correct me if I'm wrong, but was not Mitt Romney working for Bain Capital? Does not Mitt Romney have a family? Does anyone not think he might not want to retire someday and stop running for president? And here's the problem. Mitt is rich. Moreover, he's an Elmo. So he doubly doesn't matter. Obama's not trying to buy his love. Isn't it funny how if you're a rich Smurf, then that's okay. You get the Buffett rule, even though you know that you'll never pay a higher effective tax rate than your secretary under the Buffett rule. But if you're a rich Elmo, like Mitt, then you get the Mitt Romney loophole. Ooh. Listen, people. You don't think that Warren Buffett has money in a tax-free instruments shielded from the truly greedy entity that's known as our federal government? Of course he does. But he's a Smurf, and so his richness is American, and Mitt's richness is not. It would bar contributions, reduction of the Mitt Romney loophole, would bar contributions to tax-preferred accounts once balances reached about $3.4 million, which the administration says is enough to provide $210,000 in annual income. So now, not only has Obama Hood classified you as rich if you make $200,000 a year, but he has also decided that you will be limited to $200,000 a year in your retirement years as well. And at the same time, the administration would expand tax breaks for small businesses that automatically enroll their employees in retirement savings accounts. Look, I'm all for tax breaks for small businesses. We got to get them up and off the ground and running and competing with bigger businesses. But this is exactly the type of thing that years down the road, Smurfs will refer to as corporate welfare. Tax credits intended to encourage a specific economic action, in this case, enrolling people in retirement accounts. When you break them down, they are simply money given back to the private sector business. And that's what they define as corporate welfare. And then they add that all up to act like it's like way bigger than the entitlements that are bleeding our treasury dry. And furthermore, the average person doesn't realize that small businesses aren't just mom and pop businesses or Mr. Ingenuity starting a business in his garage. These companies can be upwards 500 employees. Again, I'm all for it, but Obama Hood is deliberately taking advantage of a lack of knowledge so that he can buy the love of the masses by pretending he's against the rich and for the poor and the masses who are beginning to see the light visibly through approval ratings below 40%. This is why he's doing this. Obama is not doing this to help the middle class. He knows there's no chance that this is going to get through by hurting investment and growth and the economy and not doing other things to bolster that. Yes, it's good to give tax credits or tax cuts and even credits to the middle class. That will be consumer spending going right back into the economy. But there are other things that create growth and create jobs and create investment and create ingenuity and create future. And he's wanting to dispose of those, even though they will hurt the middle class in the long run and the economy in the long run, only because it helps him with his ignite the flames of class warfare. Of course, the bank tax. Now, you could say this is a good thing. I say it's a good thing because what happened in 2008 was not good. The plan would impose a 7 basis point fee on the nation's approximately 100 biggest banks. The administration says it would force them to think twice about borrowing heavily. The president's proposal would attach a cost to leverage for largest financial firms, leading them to make decisions more consistent with the economy-wide effects of their actions, which would in turn help reduce the probability of major defaults. Not a problem there. 7 points would be based on various aspects of their portfolio, and charge them accordingly. Now, if they're in trouble, charging them accordingly could throw them into what they're trying to prevent, which is a major default. But the idea here is prevention. The administration says that it is broadly consistent with an excise tax then House Ways and Means Chairman Dave Camp would have imposed as part of a tax reform bill last year. Camp's plan was rejected by his fellow Republicans. So in other words, what they're trying to do is justify what they want to do by invoking some rogue Elmo that did something or suggested something as part of an overall bigger picture that his fellow Elmos rejected. Look, folks, they did Dodd-Frank, but Smurfs and Elmos teamed up together to yank the teeth from its enforcement capability over then not Senator Elizabeth Warren, whom Obama himself would not nominate to head the new Consumer Protection Agency created by Dodd-Frank. Even though the Smurfs controlled the Senate, too many Smurfs didn't like her because she was anti-bank. Timothy Geithner, Obama's Treasury Secretary, didn't like her. Banks therefore still engage in the same practices to this day that they did before 2008 meltdown. Banks are even bigger now than they were before, even though we heard incessantly too big to fail and breaking them up and making them smaller. Do you really think Obama Hood thinks he's going to get this past the now Elmo Congress? Or is he just doing this to reignite the flames of class warfare in a time where he has nothing to lose? After all, he is campaigning, not for another term, of course. Oh, no. He is campaigning for as good an exit as he can expect for a president who did nothing more than F up the recovery, throw roadblocks in the way of the private sector, and completely turn the insurance world upside down for 250 million Americans so that he could insure another net 5 million people who didn't have insurance before and then brag about it. I'm telling you, and of course, where does this lead me to? Obamacare itself. Companies are struggling to implement Obamacare. Only about half the mid-size and large companies are ready to meet the healthcare's reporting requirements, according to an ADP study. The other half need to play catch-up real quick. The close of 2014 marked the first year that Obamacare, but corporations are still struggling on how to implement its reporting and regulatory standards. Now, take note of that word, folks, regulatory. About half the midsize and large employers say that they are not fully prepared to accurately apply all of the ACA compliance standards. Take note of that word, too, folks, compliance. This, according to a new ATP study, only 46% of mid-sized companies and 51% of large companies say that they are equipped to meet the annual health care reporting requirements. The reporting has to be done and has to be done accurately, said David Marina, a vice president and managing director of ADP's Strategic Advisory Services. Someone has to sign off on these documents that they are correct, and there's a whole new level of rigor. Along with the extension of insurance coverage, which is the small part here, folks, there are a host of regulatory and record-keeping standards that businesses are required to meet. The list includes accurately tracking employee hours, reporting health insurance enrollment and eligibility to federal authorities, and ensuring health plans offered meet the minimum standards of care and affordability standards. As of this year, almost all of the ACA standards are in effect, and failure to comply could result in substantial non-deductible tax penalties ranging anywhere from thousands to millions of dollars annually. You want to talk about sucking money out of the private sector? Here we go. Do you see why it seems that Smurfs government is out to kill business. Even if it's not a Smurf's intention to kill business, the price is the same. And if it doesn't kill a business, it robs them of the capital to do so many other things. Regulatory rules and the cost of complying with those rules does even far more damage to the business than the tax policy we're talking about earlier. The ACA is one of the most significant pieces of legislation since the start of Social Security in 1935. It affects every employer and legal resident. Every employer and legal resident. In 2015, it is expected to impact almost 19% of the entire U.S. economy, according to the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Companies and patients alike are trying to keep up with the change, but progress has been slow. To cope with this, companies are finding ways to work within their current structure. For instance, many organizations don't have the ability to accurately track employee hours, especially those with few part-time workers. So these firms are finding it more efficient to extend healthcare coverage beyond mandated ACA full-time employees, which currently defines them as 30 hours or more. This is particularly true for companies with 1,000 employees or more. 3 out of 5 large corporations say they are extending coverage to all employees, regardless of full-time status. ADP found 2 reasons for this. Number 1, employers with small population of part-time workers found it less costly to cover all workers rather than set up administrative process to accurately track hours. And about 75% of the companies still view benefits as a key attraction tool. Not a problem with that. Mind you, these are companies that were already offering a plan to their full-time employees. So they are incurring additional costs in order to avoid the cost of regulatory compliance. At the end of the day, firms are likely to require more workers. And nearly 64% of mid-sized companies and 59% of large companies have multiple people in across functions making ACA decisions. Companies are responsible for accuracy of the data they provide to the health insurance marketplaces and the Internal Revenue Service that requires expertise from finance, the executive level, and human resources. Software alone isn't going to solve this for organizations, said Marini. The complexity of the task at hand is going to require a whole new set of structures within business to track and report their employees' health care coverage. These are companies that were already offering plans to their employees. It will get easier as the years go by, said Marini, but they have to figure out a way to get comfortable and get their arms around it this year. It is nice that employers offer insurance, but regulatory compliance ends up costing a business so much more than the actual premium that the law made mandatory. And even companies that were already offering insurance to their employees have had to bear the cost of complying with these new regulatory rules. Remember when Obama said, Obama said that for the 83% of us that were already insured, this law would have no, won't change anything for us. Wouldn't have any effect on us at all. We wouldn't even notice that it went into effect. That is an Obamacare lie that almost never gets mentioned. And it is the costliest lie that he told. And ACA regulatory compliance is just the tip of the iceberg, because in Obamahood's last 2 years, regulatory rules to which compliance will be expensive are one of the only 2 ways Obamahood will be insisting that he is still relevant. Now, if you get your job from a poor person, then you have nothing to worry about. But if you get your job from a corporation or a business that, as Hillary Clinton said, don't really create those jobs, then you need to deeply consider where your allegiance lies, with yourself or with an ideology based on class warfare. And maybe this would all be well and good if ACA did what we were told, sold, and fooled that it would do. But sadly, it does not. The Commonwealth Fund came out with their report on employer-sponsored health insurance premiums and deductibles, giving a 10-year premium and deductible trends in employer-sponsored coverage from 2003 to 2013, that 10-year period. and it was complete with an interactive map, which I thought was pretty cool, giving state-by-state stats. Now, some of these stats are positively embarrassing. Here in Florida, my home state, premiums slowed, deductibles soared, and premium contribution also soared. And I'm looking at this report here. Hang on one second, folks, because it's such a cool map. All you do is hover your little cursor over it, your mouse over it. And it, here in Florida, the family premiums went up at a faster rate from 2010 to 2013 than they did from 2003 to 2013. They went up at a faster clip. I'm sorry, from 2003 to 2010, they went up at a faster clip now, these last 3 years, 2010 to 2013, than they were in those first 7 years of this decade under research. And the employer contributions, the employees' contributions also went up, and the deductible also went up at a faster rate. That's in the state of Florida, my home state. I know you may not be concerned about me, but in the president's home state, Hawaii, not only have premiums increased faster, but the deductibles between 2003 and 2010 decreased on average 3.7% per year, and now they're rising 10.4% per year. So the deductibles are going through the roof. So the premiums went up in Hawaii and the deductibles went up in all at faster rates than they were the 7 years prior to Obamacare being implemented. Now, in Illinois, Obamahood's adopted home state, premiums increased faster, 4.8% per year from 2010 to 2013, rather than 4.6% the years 2003 through 2010. Let's look at Massachusetts, where they have not only MassHealth, which is RomneyCare on which Obamahood said that his plan was modeled, and on top of that, they have Obamacare. They should be doing really good, right? Sorry, folks, that would be wrong. They seem to have been triple whammied. Their premiums are rising annually 6.1% now, as opposed to 5.8% per year from 2003 to 2010. The employees' contribution to their premiums are rising 11.1% per year, as opposed to 7.7% per year from 2003 to 2010. And here's the kicker. Deductibles rose an average of 12.7% over the last 3 years versus only 5.2% per year during the years 2003 through 2010. So their deductibles are now rising 2.5 times faster per year, folks. In Massachusetts, where not only do they have Obamacare, but they also have RomneyCare. That's insanity right there. And to add insult to injury, in no state did the average premium for a typical family of four see any drop in premium, let alone $2,500 reduction Obamahood promised. Now, keep on top of that regulatory compliance cost that we were just talking about, and you have to admit that ACA was a pretty bad law. Repeal and replace? Not possible right now. As long as Obamahood is in the Oval Office, there's no chance he will sign a repeal of his own signature law. Smurfs say that they prefer an accept and fix, accept the law, understand it as imperfect, and focus on fixing those parts of the law. Well, as much as Smurfs complained that Elmo's didn't have a replacement plan for repeal and replace, you would think that they would be coming out of the woodwork with fixes for their accept and fix plan, but not one Smurf has offered a single fix to any part of this law. And the fixes that the Elmos have offered were disingenuously labeled attempts to repeal. That's right. Only 6 of the 50 ACA votes in the House were actually repeal laws. All the rest were focused on a portion of the law or its funding. So fine, the Smurfs don't like the Elmo's fixes. Where, oh where, are the Smurfs' fixes? There are none. The Smurfs really don't want to fix this law, and here's why. They know that once we fix everything in this law that needs fixing, that it will be as though we repealed and replaced it anyway. That's why ACA is bad law. Hopefully the Supreme Court will nix it this time like they should have the last time, but don't count on it. In order to repeal and replace it, whether that happens one piece at a time or all at once, the Elmos are going to need to win the White House while keeping the House and Senate, a major task that Obamahood has every motivation to distract them from. Well, that's a wrap for tonight's show, folks. I want to thank you for coming in and check our website, 1111broadcasting.com. We'll see you tomorrow night at 8 p.m. And until then, do what you love and love what you do.